Welcome to episode 3 of season 5 of the APCDA podcast entitled Career Journeys. And today we're going to meet with Tamerlane Beasley, who's the CEO and founder of Beasley Intercultural. We've just finished our chat with her, Sam, and we'll be showing that shortly. But I'm wondering, what were your key takeaways from our chat with Tamerlane?
So many. When she was sharing all the various stories and her journey itself, she came across to me as someone who is so passionately curious. So I can't find a better way to describe her. She's so passionate and she's so curious, which I guess is the reason that kept her driven behind the work that she's doing. Like she started, like the work that she likes didn't have a role for her. She created one for herself, and there was so much learning, there was so much exploration. She didn't really talk about her failures, but I can tell that she really moved through challenges after challenges. So what really inspired me from her sharing was really her attitude, and her curiosity was very contagious. How about you?
Yeah, clearly, once she'd gone to Thailand or was in Thailand as an exchange student at 16 years of age, so pretty young, she found her calling even then and went to university back in Australia and only had 2 years of full-time employment before starting her own business. To me, that's quite extraordinary. And that she was quite single-minded. And like you said, she couldn't find a job in what she wanted to do in the intercultural space. So she created her own business so she could have a job and then hustled so hard for so many years to get the contracts, the tenders, whatever it is, to get the work, good or bad, that has led her to a place now where. What did she say? Last year, 530 programs, a small core team, 18 consultants. It's hugely impressive. And it's 28 years later since she first started as the sole trader in a fledgling type of industry. Like you said, just she made it happen and she just was so clear-minded in what she wanted to do. And I didn't really ask her if, and I was thinking, and I forgot to ask, but I wanted to say, if you didn't do this, what else do you think you would be doing? That would have been a great
Wow,
question.
it would
I'll
be.
ask her that next time I see her. But just because I think we just saw the passion and how clear-minded she was in doing this and how so much about how culture shapes the way we see the world. That were some of the early words that she said about it. So I just found it's interesting. She got it comes from a different background, very arty background, ended up in the business space, but still such a voracious reader, obviously a creative person, wants to spend more time thinking in the future. Now, it was a really great discussion with Tamerlane. I think that our membership will be interested in hearing about it, and we'd love to hear your thoughts, APCDA members and anyone else who watches this. Let us know what you think. So let's get on and we'll hear from Tamerlane now. Now, Tamerlane, I know a little bit about you, but I'd really like to hear your elevator pitch. Tell us a bit more about who you are as a person, deep down, and what fascinates you and what drives you.
Wow, that's a big starting question. So, I'm someone who is absolutely passionate about engaging with people who are different and from different backgrounds and learning about the world and how people see the world differently. And I find it endlessly fascinating. And I love having conversations where my mind is stretched and I learn about the world and I learn about different organizations and I learn about the incredible breadth and diversity of the world that we inhabit, and particularly the world of work, which is just so extraordinary. And the thing I enjoy about this space is you can never get there, you're always learning.
So what drives you through all of that? Where does that all come from?
That's a really good question. So I grew up in quite an unusual family. So my parents were both yoga and meditation teachers and spent a lot of time thinking about how we think. And then it was a fairly unconventional childhood, shall we say, fairly creative, a lot of artists in my family. And growing up, it was very, a lot of music, a lot of art, a lot of reading. I'm a compulsive reader. I would read incessantly. And then when I was 16, I was a Rotary Exchange student to Bangkok, Thailand. And that really triggered a massive growth spurt, learning spurt. It came at a very key point in my life. I think that age is really important when you're still forming your identity. And so I lived in a Thai China with a Thai Chinese family and became very close to them. And went to local high school, and I came back to my family a year later speaking Thai and very confused about what has just happened. And I've spent the rest of my life trying to explore and understand what happens when people move across cultures and how does culture shape the way we see the world, the place we grow up, the language we speak, the context we're educated in, all of those factors. How does that shape our worldview and our perspective? So I became obsessed with making sense of what had just happened to me. And that's really driven me. It's a real interest and passion. And it's endlessly fascinating, I think, to be learning about how people see the world. So I went and studied Asian studies at the ANU. I did international business. I went on exchange to the US, which was actually a surprising culture shock, which I wasn't expecting. And I studied the Thai-Lao Friendship Bridge Project, one of Australia's first big infrastructure projects in Southeast Asia, looking at, and I studied Lao as well, looking at Thai and Lao perspectives of this Australian project. And because it was a bridge, it lent itself to lots of metaphors. And it was so interesting. And I was so fortunate that I got to go to the ANU at that time. It was really peak funding for Asian studies. It was in Australia, the Paul Keating era, and he was a prime minister who was really big on Asian studies. So we had very small class size. We only had about 10 people in our class, and incredible access to amazing professors at the undergraduate level, which you just don't get. I didn't realize until I went to the US that's not normal, and went to Thailand to university for a while with classmates and just kept learning and kept learning and kept engaging and kept very much closely in touch with my Thai family. And so the very early part of my career was very much driven by Thailand-Australia relationships and understanding Thailand, learning Thai, trying to speak Thai, doing a lot of consulting work in Thailand, and then gradually expanding from there.
So the exchange to Thailand, like when I was your age, I wanted to do an exchange to the US. But for you ended up in Thailand. Was that your choice or was that a bit of serendipity?
I wanted to go to French-speaking Canada because I thought that just sounded so exotic and interesting. And I'd never been overseas before when I went on exchange. So I didn't have much idea about the world, but I had studied Indonesian at high school. And so when we had to select the country we wanted to go to, it was interesting. They said to me, "Oh, you should pick Thailand. It's amazing. I think you'll be in Phuket. It's this beautiful tropical island and you'll love it. It's so amazing. And I know you've studied Indonesian, so it's not that different. I'm sure you'll be fine." And so I picked Thailand thinking it would be similar to Indonesian. Thai and Indonesian is totally different. But also, I wasn't in Phuket. I was actually in Bangkok. And Bangkok at that time, I spent up to 4 hours a day in traffic in local buses and boats and tuk-tuks and songtows, which are like the little utes with planks of wood at the back, which I think is where I learned a lot of my Thai. And so it wasn't quite what I was promised, but I wouldn't give it back for anything. But it was a real stretch. Don't want to say it was easy. As I said, I'd never been overseas before, so I was deeply homesick, and I really sitting all day from it was like what 8 till 3 in a classroom where you don't understand a word of what's being said, 5 days a week with people who at that time didn't necessarily want to engage with a foreigner. And you can hear people saying Falun when you walk past. So I was very much an outsider. But that experience of being an outsider, I think, was really very important to me because It helped me understand a little bit of what it might feel like coming to Australia, particularly for people who are doing the reverse and coming to Australia for the first time, and what it feels like to not understand and to be confused and to not be included in things and to just be watching. And so I wrote a lot during that year. I wrote journals and I wrote letters and I watched and I learnt. And at the end, after about 3 months, I was understanding what was going on around me, and then the language started coming and things got a bit easier. But my Thai family were extraordinary, and although she didn't speak a word of English, my Thai grandmother was wonderful and we really clicked. So yeah, it was an amazing experience. So I think the hard experiences are sometimes the ones that are so formational.
Thank you for sharing your experience in all this cultural exchange. I think that is always something very fascinating to me. Every time I go to a new place, it's always understanding the culture and how people are so different yet similar in many contexts. Yeah, so it's very interesting. So with all your past experience and your diverse background, could you share with us a little bit more about what you currently do? What problems do you
Sure.
solve? What do you love to do? Who do you help?
Yeah. So, as a result of that experience, I've really spent the rest of my life trying to understand intercultural communication, engagement, and inclusion as well. So, how do we create inclusive workplaces? So, I started my company initially as a sole trader in 1997 and then incorporated the company in 2001. And the company's grown a lot. So we have around 18 people who freelance and do contract work for us. And then we have a small core team. And we provide cultural training services. We're the lead provider to the federal government in Australia. So we provide pre-departure, pre-deployment training for people who are going overseas to live and work overseas at embassies, doing all sorts of work for different government agencies. We also work with big corporates. So we work in hospitality, in travel, in media, with some big Australian companies and also some multinational companies as well. So, just as an example, last year we delivered 530 programs. So we're pretty busy.
530, that's more than the number of days in a year, my
Yeah,
goodness.
so we have a lot of programs running concurrently, and those programs are delivered around the world, but predominantly in Australia. Some are online, but most are in person. But we're doing more during COVID, obviously, everything was online. Then everyone went back to in person, and now we're in the middle.
Okay, for a lot of the practitioners in our community, sometimes one of the things that we Well, some one of the things that we need to be equipped with is learning how to work with people from different culture and understanding people from different background. Now, with your experience, what would be like one or two tips that you will have for a practitioner to get up to speed into someone's cultural, understanding someone's culture?
I think the key thing in terms of people working across cultures is how people communicate and connect. And so just building self and situational awareness is what we talk about. So being aware of the way you communicate. So, for example, often Australians use very informal English and they use a lot of slang, they shorten words, they use something called banter where they make fun of people as a way of developing rapport, recognizing that those things aren't universal. And the key thing is learning how to communicate so that other people can understand you is a basic skill, but one that is often underestimated. People will think, oh, I should learn another language. Learning another language is fantastic, and I totally am an advocate for it. And I've been on many lobbying missions trying to encourage more people to study other languages, and particularly Asian languages, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't. But that said, if you speak English in a way that people can understand, that gets you a long way. So the first thing is communicate, speaking clearly. And the other thing is looking for common ground. People often think that everything's different when you work across cultures, but we share so much. And so it's finding out what is it that connects you with somebody. And so, regardless of what culture they come from, you may both be in a family of four kids, or you may both like a particular type of food, or like cooking, or whatever. Finding rapport is critically important. And I think With the way the world is at the moment, that skill around how do we find common ground with people who may be different to us is a critical skill because, and this is where it goes to our workplaces, is we need to be able to sit beside and work with people who are different. Everyone's not going to be the same. That's never going to happen. Even within a culture, people are very different. So it's a critical skill to understand that everyone won't be the same as you. People won't necessarily agree with you. And that's the reality of the world. So, how do we still find common ground with people we may disagree with? How do we disagree appropriately? How do we explore difference and actually work from that? Because what we know also is that if you tap into diverse perspectives, you can be far more creative, you can be more productive. That's what actually makes businesses thrive, is if you have everyone who thinks the same thing, it's great if you're doing process work. But these days, if you're doing process work, you're at risk of losing your job to AI. So how we tap into that diversity is really important.
Can I take you back to 1997, Tamerlane? You said you started your sole trader business. By my calculations, that's 28 years ago. It's a long time ago. You must have been pretty young. And I want to know to do this, and I want to hear a bit about those early days in the decisions, like to decide to have your sole trader business. Like, how did you get into business being quite young yourself? I can see the cultural connection for sure from your Thailand days, but it's a big step to having your own business, even as a sole trader. Take us back to 1997
I
or
didn't
96. What happened?
Yeah, I didn't really want to run my own business. I just wanted to work in the intercultural space. There were no jobs. So what happened is I've only ever worked for someone else for 2 years full time. My first job out of university, I was a conference organizer for a year. And then I got a job at the University of New South Wales running exchange programs, student exchange programs. And about 90% of the workload was actually doing transfer of credit. So it was very administrative. It was all about this subject equals that subject. And it wasn't, but the highlight, the absolute highlight was the pre-departure training and the re-entry training and working with the students who were going on exchange and learning from the students who came in. But the problem was that only happened twice a year. So I thought, this is what I want to do. So I ended up quitting my job, but continuing on with the international office, doing a little bit of casual work. And then I was very fortunate. I got onto a program, which was a New South Wales government program, where, or maybe it was federal, I can't remember, but you could get the DOL, which is like welfare in Australia, if you were setting up a small business. So they would pay you the DOL, but you didn't have to be applying for jobs. You had to do a small business course, which was 6 weeks. And then you had a business mentor, and you were part of a group of 20 people who were all starting their small business. So I was part of this small business group, and it was with people who were starting dog walking businesses and vegetable delivery, all sorts of things. And so I started my business, but literally, I had no money at all. Like, I had to sell my car because I couldn't afford the registration. I was living in a group house. So it was the back room, the spare room of the group house was where the business was based. And I remember I'll never forget the first proposal I sent, and it was by fax. It's that long ago. But I didn't even know what an invoice was. Like, I honestly had no idea. And so I was waitressing. It took years. So I had to learn a lot of skills. Like, to be an intercultural trainer, I had to learn how to, unfortunately, I had to learn how to run a business, not just how to train. I had to learn how to be a trainer. So I did a train the trainer course, one of the TAFE courses. And then I got some casual work through a friend of a friend, which was actually really good. I learned so much from it. It was delivering training for TAFE, which is a vocational college in Australia, casual training on standard call answering for the tax office. So it was like the Australian Tax Office. When you used to call them, you get someone answering saying, "Hello, this is John. Good morning, Australian Tax Office." And someone else would answer and say, "Australian Tax Office, this is John." What I had, it was this training where you had to travel, and I traveled around Australia delivering this training. And it was really good practice because a lot of people really hated the fact that they had to do this. So I had to deal with resistant audiences, and it really didn't have much to do with intercultural, but I learned how to be a trainer. And then gradually, through networking, I did a lot of networking. I started to get little opportunities to do little pieces of work. So I started doing some work training New South Wales police and youth workers, which again was a really good practice on dealing with resistant audiences because they were like, we don't need this stuff. You can't tell us anything. So I really had to work hard at that. I volunteered a lot. So I volunteered at the University of Sydney, setting up the Mekong Resource Centre, using my skills to keep involved in the academic research around Southeast Asia. And then I got a break. I got some casual training work with the United Nations with ESCAP in Bangkok, the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific. And so it was training that was being rolled out from New York, and all the trainers were going around, and I went and got trained by them and then had to deliver this training. And I do some in English, and then they liked to use me because I could train people who couldn't really speak English. So I'd deliver training in Thai. And so I did that for about 8 years on and off. And all these things started to happen. And then we won our first big contract, which was terrifying but exciting. And that was for a program called the Youth Ambassadors for Development. And that was doing pre-departure training for 120 people. And we had 3 weeks' notice, and I had to pull together a team, and we did a 5-day program. And it was extraordinary, and it was joyous. And the beautiful thing is, I still run into people who did that program. Like, I'll run into them at airports. They're now, many of them are very senior people, and that's their first because they were going as volunteers internationally. And it was such a big experience for them that they remember the training. And it's so meaningful, those relationships. So, yeah, but it wasn't easy, I must admit. And I didn't make much money, and I had to do everything and anything to, I was waitressing, I was doing all sorts of things and doing random weird jobs just to keep the bills paid. But you'd get little opportunities, and gradually they grew and they grew. And through each one, you'd learn more and you'd learn more, and then you'd learn. But it was scary, I must admit, because I was young as well. I was younger than the people I was training most of the time. Yeah. So I think it was a bit naive. Sometimes when you're young, you'll just do it. Yeah. Confronting fear is a big part of it. And I think I still get nervous, and it's still that you never get there when you have your own business, and you never take things for granted, and the world constantly changes. Yeah. Sorry, that's a roundabout answer, but.
It's great. It's great to hear the flow of consciousness there. I know you're originally from country Victoria in Australia, right? And
Yeah.
you said you came from an arty family and then you started this business. Tell us a bit about who you were as a young person, even before you ended up in Bangkok when you were 16. Can you see what got you here?
I was often up a tree reading a book when I was young. I read constantly. Like, I used to read a book a day on holidays and read till my eyes ached, which I think is really part of that wanting to understand how people see the world differently as well. And a way of broadening your horizons. So I was a kid who I loved to read and I loved to learn. And I remember even when I graduated from university, I couldn't understand why everyone came and there was such a celebration. It was like an achievement. I thought, this has been one of the most joyous experiences of my life. Why is it such a big deal that you've achieved it? This is the fun stuff, right? This is what everyone wants to do. Being in a group of people and learning and growing and traveling and although that said, I did enroll in a double degree, which I only lasted 6 weeks in the other half of it. If I had have stuck with that, maybe it wouldn't have been so joyous. But yeah, as a kid, I think very creative as well. So I grew up in a family where we really didn't have money. So I was always thinking of ways to earn a bit of money. I grew up working even before you're allowed to work. So I'd go around when the carnival came to town and ask if anyone had work before I could legally work. And I'd work selling hot dogs and whatever so I could do cash in hand. And then to go on exchange, I worked in a supermarket to save up and buy the airfare. And then through even at school, I used to make things and sell them. Like I used to make craft things and sell them because that was the only way I could get the money I wanted. So I was always having to hustle a bit and be creative because we didn't have money. And so even then, like going to university, I was working. And when I went on it, when I told my parents I wanted to go on exchange to the US, they were just like, oh, honestly, how are you going to pay for that? And it was pretty tricky. I had five jobs when I was there to keep going. So I've always had to work really hard. But I think that expands your capacity to understand difference as well. So the breadth of jobs through university, I was cleaning houses and babysitting and working. And I was working in an office at the university. And I actually worked in a career center at the university. So I had a job in that was for in my final year, which was interesting because obviously at the end of graduation, then I was applying for jobs. And I remember I went to the career center people and said, here's my CV, this is the job I want to go for. And I'll never forget it. One of the women said, oh, the most you can hope for is that you could be an assistant to that person. And I was very happy that I got the job. So that was being the corporate conference organizer. But it was great because the application for that job is you had to organize a conference. They gave you a couple of hours and said, what would you do? And you had to pull it together. And so then they tested me, how did you do it? And I was like, oh, I just called people and talked to them. And they're like, fantastic. Okay, you got the job. So I think through all of those experiences of working constantly through my life, like by the time I was starting my business, although I didn't really know much about business, I'd been working with different people and learning that you can ask things and people will help you. And as long as you're willing to put the effort in, you can learn things. It's not, yeah. So it's constantly learning.
You were hustling before hustling was a thing.
Yes. You
Maybe,
kept me
yeah.
breathless. You kept me breathless when you were sharing your entire growing up journey and all the various work and assignments that you have taken. There's so much action involved in your entire career journey. I'm just wondering, I'm very curious, what, in your personal opinion, which is the most important career decision to date that you have taken so far?
Oh, that's a big question. The most important career decision to date. It's interesting because I don't know if I made decisions per se. I think the decisions, it's like when you have a business and you have to, like, I've been supporting a family and paying a mortgage. And it's if the work's there, you have to get it and you have to do the work, whether you like it or not, whether you want to or not. So it's not. In some ways, it's not even having a decision. It's constantly just making the effort to go, what can we do now? What can we do now? How do we deal with this? How do we? You're so busy actually trying to make things happen. And I've been juggling a family and I'm a carer. I've got a lot going on personally as well, less now, but my kids are getting older. But I've had a lot going on. So I've been a primary caregiver as well. So it's been really busy, and I'm looking forward to having a little bit less on my plate in a way on that side of things. So, in terms of decisions, because I've been within my business the whole time, it's been fairly much rolling along. I think difficult decisions in a business is when you decide that you need to part ways with somebody who's not values aligned. Or I've made decisions to part ways with clients that aren't values aligned. And that's scary because you need to pay the bills. But I've had a couple of clients. There was one where I gave a lot of advice, but they never took my advice. And I was very publicly advising that client. And so, from a values perspective, I felt uncomfortable. So I actually said, look, I don't think this is working. And that was after working with them for many years. And I really cared for the people. But this is not values aligned in that you're doing things that I'm not comfortable with in terms of this is not what I'm advising, and everyone sees you know, that I'm your advisor. So that's hard to actually make that call. I think sometimes it's easier to just keep bubbling along, but from my perspective, some of the really hard calls are it's very uncomfortable and very difficult sometimes to decide that something's not right. And pretending that it is or thinking it's going to get better. Whereas making those decisions, particularly personnel decisions when you run a business, is hard. That's something I really don't like, but you have to do it. You have to keep true to the values of yourself and the business. And other people will see that if you're not, it's not good for everyone if you're not making the right decision in the interests of the business. So that's where being the boss, sometimes I love the work so much, but being the boss sometimes can be a bit of a drag.
Yeah, it sounds really difficult. I think that is really tough call. Like you can keep things running the way it is, or just really make a hard stop to say that, hey, no, this is not gonna work. I think it requires a lot of courage to turn down something, to terminate a relationship. I think it's tough.
I think too, like we've had a couple of people, some organizations who've approached us, and there's industries we just won't work with. We won't work with tobacco companies. We won't work with gambling companies. Values, from my perspective, as long as you're true to your values, everything else is a bit easier. But if you're compromising your values, then I think the thing is too, is because I grew up without money, I grew up in a family of, I was very fortunate and I still am. My family are wonderful, but artists and people who are very creative, is that I know that you can live very happily with not much. If you, as long as you, for example, if I love reading, as long as there's a library, I'm happy. So that helps you sometimes make those decisions because you don't need all the fancy stuff. I'm driven to actually make a difference in the work I do. It's, I don't, it's not just, I'm not in it. And I was never in the business for the money. It's, the money is a vehicle to enable employing the people to do the work to make a difference. Yeah. Sorry, I can't remember why I was telling you that.
No, it's all good. I want to
No,
know,
okay.
Tamerlane, what's next for you?
That's a really good question. And it's something that I'm giving a lot of thought to at the moment. Beasley Intercultural has grown, particularly in the last 3 years. We've grown really fast and we've grown a lot. And we're just catching our breath after a period of huge busyness. For me, I'm going to the point about how much I enjoy writing and thinking and engaging with people. I'm really keen to do some more, do some writing and some publishing and create more content and be back doing the really intercultural thinking and engagement that means so much to me. But in order to do that, I need to also ensure that the structure of the business is such that the business can continue with me not as quite as involved in the day-to-day as I have been in the last couple of years, which has meant that I haven't been able to do that thinking and writing. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to have a bit more time to reflect on things and share what I know and what I've learned from working with tens of thousands of people and so many organizations around the world. Because we've learned so much at Beasley Intercultural. And it's interesting when we look at research or I go to international conferences, you might go to a session and someone's talking about a sample size of 40 students for their research. And I think we've worked with tens of thousands of people in terms of exploring what patterns are and testing different ways and bringing all, we're very multidisciplinary in what we do. So it's organizational psychology, behavioral psychology, learning and development. You know, this, we draw on a huge breadth. And so, what we've learned works, and what helps people navigate complexity and work effectively in a global context, I think it's really important to share that in ways that people can access it more readily. So, I'm very keen to start doing more writing and sharing and publishing. When I had a bit more time many years ago, I was starting to do a bit more media. So I was doing TV and stuff like that. And that all went a bit quiet because we've been too busy. We've been so busy doing the work, we haven't had time to actually publish and put it out there. So I'm looking forward to that.
All right. If you could give a teaser, perhaps a prelude to your up and coming publishing, what would be one thing that you would like to share that you have in the past, in all the past work that you have done, in the tens of thousands of people that you have trained?
I think the key thing is to be willing to sit slightly outside of your comfort zone. Is that if you sit in the heart of your comfort zone, you don't tend to learn. It's a pearl is created when there's a bit of sand in the oyster. There's that,
Irritation.
it's that slight irritation and rub that enables the magic and the synergy to happen. And I think we sometimes get very comfortable and we assume we want to be comfortable. It's fair enough. But the learning, the really good learning, often happens at the edge or out of our comfort zone. And so learning the skills, and this is Beasley Intercultural, we're very big on skills and capability. It's not just understanding intellectually, it's how you do it. Having the resilience to sit with discomfort and continue learning and keep doing the job and keep engaged with people is not easy, but doing that is really important. And so I think from a career perspective, it's recognizing that you're not going to get the perfect job. There is no per I don't think there's a perfect job. There's jobs that have joyous elements to them, but there's always a bit you don't like that you have to do. And to get into that space, you have to learn. And from my experience, you have to be willing to move in very indirect ways sometimes. And a lot of my career only makes sense looking back. You know, that classic metaphor that you climb the hill and you look back and you see the path through the trees. But when you're in the forest, it feels a bit confusing. And so to sit in that confusion and keep going, I'm heading in this direction and this feels right, and trusting your gut, but sticking with your values is so important. So that's a bit of a long answer, but it's be willing to keep learning is the key thing. And keep connected with other people. Look for what you share.
So this sounds like it's your career advice as well, but I wonder, is there any piece of career advice that you have been given at any stage of your career that you think was also really useful?
I think it's the people who actually tell you it's going to be okay and that this moment is just a moment and it will pass and things will get easier. And it's interesting, some of the career advice I've got has been dreadful. You know, those people who are like that, you're never going to get that job.
Yeah. Thanks.
I think the career advice, often it's reassurance when you're holding your course and you're staying true to your values in the face of what may seem a little unusual, but it's expanding. It's sticking with the learning in the recognition that you will get somewhere, even though it may not make sense at that time. So that the people who are willing to see your journey and sit, stand beside you and not be too directive. I think, people who are very directive and very specific, sometimes it doesn't necessarily help. So sometimes it's that guiding friend and coaching conversation is so important.
Yeah, a bit like when I coach with people, I was just thinking about this earlier today. Like I often say that you're the pilot, I'm your co-pilot.
It's because no one else knows your life and the complexity of it and your personal relationships and everything. But I do think having someone outside of yourself who can remind you of the bigger picture and the patterns that they're seeing is so valuable. So I think that role of a listener and as someone who reflects to you and says, when people tend to be in this situation, have you thought about these are common patterns that I'm hearing from you? Those things can be incredibly helpful. And I've had advisors throughout my career. So I have an advisory board chair now. I've had business coaches. I've been in courses, lots of different courses around women in leadership and business and whatever. And you always take something from it. You never know everything. And often it's also learning from other people on similar journeys who are a couple of steps ahead of you.
Yeah, great. Oh, I think that's all that we have time for today. And it's been a fascinating journey hearing about your career journey. So thanks so much for your time today, Tamerlane Beasley.
No problem. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks.